The next category of third-party assault cases deals with the liability of schools in negligence for assaults by or on students. The first subcategory of school liability we will look at is student-on-student assault in a non-recreational setting. In the first case in your materials, Brownstein, the student who allegedly assaulted plaintiff, also a student, had threatened plaintiff and school personnel were aware of the threat. The complaint alleged negligent supervision. Schools are under a duty to adequately supervise the students in their charge, and they will be held liable for foreseeable injuries directly related to the absence of adequate supervision. In determining whether this duty to provide adequate supervision has been breached, it must be shown that the school authorities had sufficiently specific knowledge or notice of the dangerous conduct which caused the injury. In other words, the assault must have been foreseeable from the school's standpoint. The school moved for summary judgment and the student made a cross motion for summary judgment. The court noted that where a motion for summary judgment is timely, an untimely cross motion for summary judgment will be considered. There was a question of fact whether the school's response to the threat was adequate. There was also a question of fact whether the plaintiff voluntarily engaged in the fight, which precluded summary judgment on the plaintiff's cross motion. In the next case, Conklin, the appellate court ruled the school district's motion for summary judgment in this negligent supervision case should have been granted. School personnel had been alerted to the possibility of an impending fight between the student and another student, the plaintiff and another student. Plaintiff's father learned of the impending fight by reading his daughter's MySpace page. He alerted school personnel. Both students were interviewed by school personnel. The student who ultimately attacked plaintiff assured school personnel she did not intend to fight plaintiff. Two classes later, plaintiff was suddenly attacked from behind by the other student in the hallway as they were changing classes. The assault was deemed unforeseeable as a matter of law. Although the student who assaulted plaintiff had in the past screamed at plaintiff, called her names, and thrown her pen on the floor, she had not been violent. The court held the school had adequately responded to the rumor of the impending fight and could not have anticipated the sudden assault. In the next case, Mathis, student plaintiff alleged another student held him partially outside a fourth floor window at the school. The complaint alleged negligent supervision. In determining whether the duty to provide adequate supervision has been breached, school authorities must be shown to have had specific knowledge or notice of the dangerous conduct which caused the injury. Actual or constructive notice to the school of prior similar conduct generally is required. The school moved for summary judgment alleging a lack of notice of the dangerous conduct which caused the injury. The court did not explain the facts, but noted that the papers submitted by the school raised questions of fact about its knowledge of the offending student's involvement in other altercations with other classmates in the recent past. Apparently, the prior conduct by the offending student did not involve plaintiff or holding a student outside the window. The evidence of altercations with other students was deemed sufficient to raise questions of fact about the school's notice of the offending student's conduct, the foreseeability of the conduct which targeted the plaintiff, and negligent supervision as the proximate cause of plaintiff's injuries. The court dismissed the lawsuit against New York City, noting that the Board of Education, the proper party, is a separate and distinct entity. In the next case, Cruz, the student plaintiff alleged she was attacked by two other students. The suit against the school alleged negligent supervision. The court noted that the summary judgment papers submitted by the school did not demonstrate that the assault was unforeseeable or that it had no actual or constructive notice of prior similar conduct. Therefore, the school's motion for summary judgment was dismissed without considering the plaintiff's papers. In the next case in your materials, Amendola, the student plaintiff alleged he was assaulted by another student several times and was repeatedly kicked by a group of students inside a classroom. The suit against the school alleged negligent supervision and negligent hiring and retention. The school moved for summary judgment on both causes of action. The school failed to negate a prima facie case on either theory, requiring dismissal of the motion without the need to consider plaintiff's papers. The papers failed to eliminate all triable issues of fact about whether the school defendants had knowledge of the offending student's dangerous propensities arising from his involvement in other altercations with the plaintiff. The papers failed to eliminate all triable issues of fact about whether a teacher failed to take energetic steps to intervene to prevent the plaintiff's injuries at the hands of a group of his classmates. Without discussing the elements of negligent hiring and retention, or the facts relevant to that cause of action, the court found the school defendants did not demonstrate it was entitled to summary judgment on the negligent retention and hiring cause of action. In the next case, Lavallee, the student plaintiff was assaulted by another student after the school had been alerted to threats of violence made by the student to the plaintiff. The offending student had a history of assaultive behavior for which he had been suspended in middle school. Plaintiff was punched 37 times in the school cafeteria. A nearby teacher did not intervene and was unaware of the history of conflict. The student sued, alleging negligent supervision. The school moved for summary judgment. The court noted that the facts must be viewed in the light most favorable to the plaintiff, the non-moving party. Schools are under a duty to adequately supervise the students, and they will be held liable for foreseeable injuries directly related to the absence of adequate supervision. The duty is breached if the school had actual or constructive notice of the conduct that caused the injury, such that the conduct of the offending student could have been reasonably anticipated. There was evidence the plaintiff's mother had brought up the conflict with the offending student in a meeting with the principal and her son's teachers. The principal testified he spoke to the offending student about the conflict, but the offending student denied that the principal had spoken to him. Questions of fact had been raised about the adequacy of the school's supervision and whether the lack of adequate supervision was a proximate cause of the student's injuries. In the next case, Emmanuel. The student plaintiff was injured when another student pushed him into a bookcase. The plaintiff's teacher had been notified the offending student had been taunting and bullying plaintiff. The school administration had been notified plaintiff was being taunted and bullied by students who were not identified. The plaintiff sued the school, alleging negligent supervision. The school moved for summary judgment, which was granted on appeal. The court explained that a student's unanticipated acts causing injury to another student will generally not give rise to a school's liability in negligence absent actual or constructive notice of prior similar conduct. Here, the record contained no evidence that the school had noticed the offending student had a proclivity to engage in physically aggressive conduct. The evidence that plaintiff had complained to his teacher and others that the offending student was picking on him and calling him names, and that his mother had called the principal's office and reported that some unidentified boys were picking on her son, shows only that the school knew that the offending student had been picking on plaintiff verbally. Knowledge of the taunting did not give the school sufficiently specific knowledge or notice of prior conduct similar to the unanticipated injury-causing act by the offending student to support a finding of actual or constructive notice of the risk that he would engage in violent or physically aggressive behavior against plaintiff. The court also found there was no question of fact whether any alleged negligent supervision was a proximate cause of plaintiff's injuries. There is no basis for finding that any greater level of supervision than was provided would have prevented the sudden and spontaneous altercation between the two students. Schools are not insurers of safety and cannot be expected to continuously supervise and control all movements and activities of students. In the next case, Maldari, the student plaintiff had been bullied by other students at his high school. The bullying included verbal taunts, pushing or bumping into the plaintiff, and an incident in the cafeteria where another student grabbed him and simulated what the court described as a lewd act. The plaintiff sued, alleging negligent supervision. The court found the incident in the cafeteria was impulsive and unanticipated. The school demonstrated it had no actual or constructive notice of prior similar conduct, and therefore the assault was not foreseeable. The next case, Matter of Regan, is mentioned here simply to point out General Municipal Law Section 50-E requires that a notice of claim be filed as a condition precedent to a negligent suit against the school district. Here, the notice of claim was not filed within the required 90 days, and plaintiff sought permission to file a late notice. The appellate court held Supreme Court should have granted permission. The student plaintiff had been confronted and threatened by two students. Plaintiff's mother informed the school and asked for a meeting with the two students' parents. Nothing was done by the school. 1 week later, the plaintiff was beaten by the two students. Whether the school had timely knowledge of the essential facts of the suit within 90 days after the claim arose, or a reasonable time thereafter, is a factor given great weight in determining whether to grant leave to serve a late notice of claim. Here the school defendants received the petition for leave to serve a late notice of claim approximately 1 month after the expiration of the 90-day period. Therefore, they had timely actual knowledge of the essential facts. In another notice of claim case, Turlington, the appellate court found that the student's application to file a late notice of claim against the school should not have been granted. The application was made 1 year after the incident. Apparently, the student was injured by a student who was subject to an order of protection requiring the student to stay away from the school attended by the injured student. The injured student demonstrated the school had timely knowledge of the order of protection, but did not demonstrate the school had timely knowledge of any injuries resulting from the violation of the order of protection. Knowledge of the injuries, rather than notice of the underlying incident, is necessary to establish actual knowledge of the essential facts of the claim within the meaning of the general municipal law. The student did not meet her burden of demonstrating the school had actual timely knowledge of the injuries. In the next case in your materials, Lennon, the two student plaintiffs were in a field trip group of sixth grade students in an exhibition room at the Bronx Zoo when they were knocked down by another student named Ryan as he ran toward the exit door. The plaintiff sued, alleging negligent supervision. The school moved for summary judgment, and the majority held the motion was properly denied. The facts were laid out in the dissent, which argued the school's motion for summary judgment should have been granted. Ryan and two or three other children were part of a group chaperoned by three parents, including Ryan's mother. Five teachers from the middle school also accompanied the children on the field trip. The student plaintiffs alleged Ryan intentionally pushed them. According to Ryan, he was running because another student was chasing him, and he accidentally collided with the plaintiffs when he tried to get through a gap between them to reach the exit door. The dissent argued, one, Ryan's act was impulsive and could not have been anticipated, and two, nothing in Ryan's disciplinary record could have put the school on notice he would run into other students, and three, The incident happened so quickly, no amount of supervision could have prevented it. The fact that the school's motion for summary judgment was, in the eyes of the majority, properly denied may have reflected gaps in the school's papers, rather than the strength of plaintiff's negligent supervision cause of action. The majority explained that the school's submissions failed to eliminate all triable issues of fact as to whether the school had actual or constructive notice of the student's potential for causing harm, and whether, under the circumstances, the school provided adequate supervision during the field trip. In the next case, Braun, B-R-A-U-N, the student plaintiff was punched by another student on a school bus. The plaintiff sued, alleging negligent supervision. The bus company moved for summary judgment, which was properly granted. The bus driver did not see the incident. Neither the plaintiff nor the offending student had been involved in or witnessed any other fights on the school bus. The court explained that, like a school bus company has a duty to adequately supervise children in its care and to exercise the same degree of care toward them as would a parent. To be liable for a student-on-student assault, the bus company must have had notice of prior similar conduct and must have had the opportunity to prevent the injury. The bus company demonstrated it had no notice of any violent propensities or disciplinary problems on the part of the offending student, and the punch was sudden and unforeseeable. Any lack of supervision could not have been a proximate cause of the injuries. In the next case, Victoria, the student plaintiff was sexually assaulted at school. The jury found the school was negligent in its supervision of its students, but that the negligence was not the proximate cause of plaintiff's injury. The appellate division determined the verdict was properly set aside as against the weight of the evidence. The issues of negligence and proximate cause were inextricably interwoven. Finding the negligence was not the proximate cause of injury was against the weight of the evidence. In the next case, Guerriero, G-U-E-R-R-I-E-R-O, the student plaintiff was punched by another student in a classroom with a teacher present. The court noted that the school itself is not an entity which can be sued. Here, the proper defendant was the school district. The plaintiff sued the school district, alleging negligent supervision. Depositions of the student plaintiff and the teacher were submitted by the school district in support of its motion for summary judgment. According to the submitted depositions, 1 month before he was punched, the student plaintiff told the teacher the offending student had been pushing his head up and down during class and slapping him in the back of the head. On the date of the assault, the teacher glanced up from her computer a few times while her students were entering the classroom. The assault happened when students were entering the classroom over the course of approximately 1.5 to 2 minutes. During this 1.5 to 2 minute period, the offending student blocked the doorway, pushed plaintiff into a desk, and followed plaintiff to plaintiff's own desk, despite the fact that the boys did not sit near each other. The plaintiff repeatedly told the offending student to stop before the offending student punched him. The court found that the depositions raised questions of fact about several elements of negligent supervision and denied the school's motion for summary judgment without considering the plaintiff's papers. The decision includes an excellent summary of the elements of a negligent supervision action, so it's worth going through them. Schools have a duty to adequately supervise the students in their care and may be held liable for foreseeable injuries proximately related to the absence of adequate supervision. The standard for determining whether the school district has breached its duty is to compare the school's supervision and protection to that of a parent of ordinary prudence placed in the same situation and armed with the same information. The plaintiff generally must demonstrate that the school district knew or should have known of the offending student's propensity to engage in violence, such that the individual's acts could be anticipated or were foreseeable. Actual or constructive notice to the school district of similar prior conduct is generally required because school personnel cannot reasonably be expected to guard against all of the sudden, spontaneous acts that take place among students on a daily basis. An injury caused by the impulsive, unanticipated act of a fellow student ordinarily will not give rise to a finding of negligence, absent proof of prior conduct that would have put a reasonable person on notice to protect against the injury-causing act. Even if a breach of the duty of supervision is established, the inquiry is not ended. The question arises whether such negligence was the proximate cause of the injuries. The test to be applied is whether, under all the circumstances, the chain of events that followed the negligent act or omission was a normal or foreseeable consequence of the situation created by the school's negligence. Where an accident occurs in so short a span of time that even the most intense supervision could not have prevented it, any lack of supervision is not the proximate cause of the injury. Proper supervision depends largely on the circumstances surrounding the event. Liability from injury caused by a fight cannot be predicated upon supervisory negligence if the plaintiff voluntarily entered into the fight. Here, the school defendants failed to demonstrate they lacked notice of the offending student's propensity to assault the student plaintiff. As to proximate cause, the school defendants did not demonstrate that the incident occurred so quickly and spontaneously that even the most intense supervision could not have prevented it. The school defendants did not show that the incident involved the type of unforeseen, spontaneous acts of violence for which school districts cannot be held liable, or that the teacher had no time to prevent the student plaintiff's injuries, and therefore the alleged negligent supervision was not a proximate cause of the infant plaintiff's injuries. The school defendants did not demonstrate the student plaintiff voluntarily entered into a fight with the offending student. The student plaintiff's testimony demonstrated the existence of triable issues of fact about whether he acted in self-defense. Because the school defendants did not submit proof negating several of the elements of negligent supervision, the court did not need to consider the plaintiff's papers. At this point, I'll insert the third verification code for the CLE. The third verification code is MANGO. Again, the third verification code for this CLE is MANGO. The next subcategory of school liability for third-party assaults looks at student-on-student assault during recreational activities. In the first case, DeMisa, the student plaintiff alleged she was intentionally pushed to the ground by another student during a kickball game. The student sued the school, but also sued the student who allegedly pushed her under a battery theory. Only the denial of summary judgment on the battery cause of action was appealed. The case is included here just to point out that a battery theory may be viable in this recreational assault context because the assumption of the risk doctrine does not apply. The court specifically ruled that the battery cause of action was not precluded by the assumption of the risk doctrine. To recover damages for battery, a plaintiff must prove that there was bodily conduct made with intent and offensive in nature. There were questions of fact whether the defendant student's actions were intentional or offensive. The assumption of the risk doctrine does not cover risks resulting from either reckless or intentional conduct. The next case in your materials, Duffy, most likely did not involve an intention to harm the plaintiff student. It is included here because of its discussion of the scope of a school's obligation to supervise, extending to after-school recreational activities, and the unavailability of the assumption of risk doctrine to what is termed horseplay. These concepts are equally relevant to an intentional as opposed to a negligent or reckless act in the recreational context. Here the student plaintiff was horsing around for 20 minutes or so before football practice started. He and other players were misusing a blocking sled to catapult them into the air. There were no coaches or other supervisors around. The student plaintiff was catapulted 10 or 15 feet into the air and broke both wrists when he hit the ground. The student plaintiff sued the school district, alleging negligent supervision. The school district moved for summary judgment, and the motion court granted the motion. The appellate court reversed. The court found that the school did not relinquish custody of the student plaintiff merely because classes ended. The junior varsity coach had the responsibility to supervise the players at the time of the injuries. The court further found that the assumption of the risk doctrine did not apply to what was characterized as horseplay. The doctrine of primary assumption of risk facilitates the free and vigorous participation in athletic activities by placing the risk of participation on the participants themselves rather than on the sponsor. The doctrine encourages sponsorship, which leads to more opportunities to participate in sports or other recreational activities. The use of the blocking sled to catapult each other into the air is not the sort of socially valuable voluntary activity that the doctrine seeks to encourage. The school defendants did not demonstrate the commonly appreciated risks which are inherent in football, included the risk of injury after being catapulted through the air by a blocking sled. In the next case, Perez, the student plaintiff was struck by a ball kicked by another student during recess. This case, like the Duffy case just discussed, probably did not involve an intention to harm the plaintiff student, but as in Duffy, the supervision issues would apply to intentional as well as a negligent or reckless act on the playground. The student plaintiff was standing in an area where students were not allowed to play sports. A classroom aide and a substitute teacher were nearby. The student plaintiff sued, alleging negligent supervision. The school district moved for summary judgment. The motion court denied the motion. The appellate division reversed, finding that the school provided adequate supervision and supervision was not the proximate cause of the injury. The court explained that schools are not insurers of safety because they cannot be expected to continuously supervise and control all movements and activities of students. Therefore, schools cannot be held liable for every thoughtless or careless act by which one pupil may injure another. In the next case, Thomas, the student plaintiff, was playing basketball in gym class when another student grabbed his left arm from behind and threw or dragged him to the ground as he tried to shoot. The student plaintiff sued the New York City Department of Education, alleging negligent supervision. The court noted that New York City is not a proper party to the suit alleging negligence on the part of the Department of Education. The Department of Education moved for summary judgment, and the motion court denied the motion. The appellate division reversed, finding that the incident was spontaneous and happened so fast no amount of supervision could have prevented it. The court also found that the prior conduct of the offending student did not put the Department of Education on notice. Therefore, supervision could not have been the proximate cause of plaintiff student's injuries. In the next case, Scavelli, the student plaintiff was tripped by another student during a speedball game. The student plaintiff sued the school district, alleging negligent supervision and instruction. The student plaintiff also sued the offending student alleging negligence and recklessness. The school district and the offending student moved for summary judgment. The motion court denied the motions. The appellate division reversed over an extensive dissent. The court noted that the compulsory nature of the gym class precluded the assumption of risk doctrine. However, the evidence submitted by the school district demonstrated the incident occurred so quickly that it could not have been prevented by even the most intense supervision. Evidence the offending student had previously shoved another student in gym class did not put the school district on notice of the type of behavior which injured the student plaintiff. In the next case, Osmanzai, that's Osmanzai, the 7-year-old plaintiff was playing tag at a summer day camp in a school gymnasium when he was pushed and injured by another camper who was not involved in the game. The day camp was operated by a corporate entity in partnership with the New York City Department of Education. At the time of the incident, 25 to 30 campers were being supervised by 5 teenagers. The adult teacher had left the room to go to the bathroom. Plaintiff alleged the teenagers were texting and talking among themselves, not watching the campers. None of the teenagers came to plaintiff's aid when he was pushed. The plaintiff sued, alleging negligent supervision. The defendants moved for summary judgment. The motion was properly denied. The court indicated the negligent supervision criteria applied to a school-run summer day camp is virtually the same as would be applied to a school. As the court explained, camps owe a duty to supervise the campers and will only be held liable for foreseeable injuries proximately caused by the absence of adequate supervision. An injury caused by the impulsive, unanticipated act of a camper ordinarily will not give rise to a finding of negligence absent proof of prior conduct that would have put a reasonable person on notice to protect against the injury-causing act. The pushing of the plaintiff during a game may have been an impulsive act that could not have been anticipated, and it may have happened so suddenly that no amount of supervision could have prevented it. The decision doesn't address those issues. The motion for summary judgment was denied because the motion papers were deemed insufficient without considering the plaintiff's papers. Perhaps the denial of the motion then does not reflect the strength of the plaintiff's allegations of negligent supervision. The next subcategory of cases in this school liability section addresses assaults by students on school employees. In the first case in this subcategory, Guerrieri, that's G-U-E-R-R-I-E-R-I, the plaintiff was a school bus driver employed by an independent contractor which contracted with the New York City Department of Education. The plaintiff driver was assaulted by a student. The Department of Education moved for summary judgment and the motion court properly granted the motion. The court explained that a municipality's liability for negligently exercising a governmental function depends on whether there is a special relationship between the municipality and the plaintiff. A school district owes a special duty to its students to supervise them and prevent injuries, but no special duty is owed by the school district to its employees. Here the school, the Department of Education, demonstrated it did not owe a special duty to the plaintiff driver and therefore could not be held liable for negligent supervision of the offending student. In the next case in the materials, Broomer, a teacher was injured when a student hit her. The teacher sued the New York City Department of Education, apparently alleging negligent supervision. The Department of Education moved for summary judgment, which was properly granted. Although a school district owes a special duty to its students, that duty does not extend to teachers, administrators, or other adults on or off premises. The case was analyzed under the special relationship theory. A municipality cannot be held liable for negligently performing a governmental function unless there is a special relationship between the municipality and the plaintiff. A special relationship can be created in three ways. One, when the municipality violates a statutory duty enacted for the benefit of a particular class of persons. Two, when it voluntarily assumes a duty that generates justifiable reliance by the person who benefits from the duty. Or three, when the municipality assumes positive direction and control in the face of a known, blatant, or dangerous safety violation. Here, the school defendants demonstrated they did not owe plaintiff teacher a special duty such that they could be held liable for the injury caused by a student. The court noted that because there was no special relationship, the school defendants' argument they were exercising a discretionary function and governmental immunity would insulate them from liability did not need to be addressed. The next subcategory of school liability for assaults involves an assault on a student on school grounds by an unknown assailant. In the Doe case, the student plaintiff was a special needs student who was to be accompanied at all times by an aide. The student alleged in the notice of claim that she was raped by a white man in a locker room. She sought to amend the notice of claim to allege she was raped by an African-American male under the bleachers on the athletic field. Over an extensive dissent, the appellate division held that the amendment did not change the negligent supervision theory and did not prejudice the school defendants. Therefore, the amendment to the notice of claim should have been allowed. The court explained that the student plaintiff's theory of liability in the original notice of claim was that she was injured because of the school district's negligent failure to provide the level of supervision that it had previously determined was necessary for her, that being the door-to-door transportation and an aide to accompany her at all times throughout the school day. Plaintiff's claim remains that defendant was negligent in failing to supervise her, regardless of the identity of her assailant or the precise location of the attack. The next subcategory of school assault cases addresses assaults on students just after leaving school grounds. Although there may be circumstances where a school could be deemed liable for an off-premises assault, both cases summarized here found no liability. In the first case, Diaz, the plaintiff alleged he was stabbed and beaten by six gang members after he left the school grounds, about 10 feet from sawhorse barricades, which marked the school's property line. Plaintiff left the school grounds with hundreds of other students. He testified he saw the gang members, but didn't think they would hassle him. Plaintiff also alleged he attempted to re-enter the school grounds, but was denied entry by security guards. Supreme Court granted the school's motion for summary judgment, and the Second Department affirmed over a substantive dissent. The plaintiff was not assaulted on school property. The fact that the plaintiff was not in the school's custody or under its control or authority at the time of the assault was one factor in the court's analysis. Foreseeability was another factor. The court found the school did not release the plaintiff into a foreseeably hazardous situation that the school had a hand in creating. In the next case, Hernandez, the student plaintiff and her father were assaulted by other students 30 to 100 feet from the entrance of the school. The case was analyzed under the concepts of custody, control, and authority. Once the plaintiff left the school grounds, she was no longer in the physical custody or under the control of the school. Therefore, the school's duty to protect the plaintiff had ceased. As the court explained it, a school's duty is coextensive with and concomitant with its physical custody and control over a child. When that custody ceases because the child has passed out of the orbit of its authority in such a way that the parent is perfectly free to reassume control over the child's protection, the school's custodial duty also ceases. The court also found the school had not assumed a duty to protect the plaintiffs from criminal activity occurring off school grounds, but did not explain what factors were considered in reaching that conclusion. The last subcategory of school liability for assaults by or on students addresses the very limited supervisory obligations imposed in the college as opposed to the pre-college setting. Colleges generally have no duty to protect students from the dangerous conduct of other students. In Pasquaretto, the plaintiff was injured pledging for a fraternity and sued the college alleging negligent supervision of the fraternity's activities. The university defendants moved to dismiss the complaint for failure to state a cause of action, and dismissal was properly granted. The court explained that New York has rejected the doctrine of in loco parentis at the college level, and colleges in general have no legal duty to shield their students from the dangerous activity of other students. A duty may be imposed upon a college only where it has encouraged its students to participate in an activity and taken affirmative steps to supervise and control the activity. Okay, to review the issues that were raised in the liability for student-on-student assault section. Schools are under a duty to adequately supervise the students in their charge, and they will be held liable for foreseeable injuries directly related to the absence of adequate supervision. In determining whether the duty to provide adequate supervision has been breached, it must be shown that the school authorities had sufficient specific knowledge or notice of the dangerous conduct which caused the injury. In Brownstein, there was a question of fact whether the plaintiff voluntarily engaged in the fight, which precluded summary judgment on the plaintiff's cross motion. In the Conklin case, the student who assaulted plaintiff had in the past screamed at the plaintiff, called her names, and thrown her pen on the floor, but she had not been violent. The school could not have anticipated the sudden assault. In the Mathis case, where the victim was held outside a fourth floor window, the evidence of altercations with other students was deemed sufficient to raise questions of fact about the school's notice of the offending student's conduct, the foreseeability of the conduct which targeted the plaintiff, and negligent supervision as the proximate cause of the plaintiff's injuries. In the Mathis case, the court dismissed the lawsuit against New York City, noting that the Board of Education was the proper party in that case, which is a separate and distinct entity. In Cruz, the court noted that the summary judgment papers submitted by the school did not demonstrate that the assault was unforeseeable or that it had no actual or constructive notice of prior similar conduct. Therefore, the school's motion for summary judgment was dismissed without considering the opposing papers. In Amendola, it was alleged the teacher failed to take adequate steps to intervene in the assault. The negligent hiring and retention cause of action survived summary judgment, which may reflect the overall insufficiency of the school's motion papers as opposed to the strength of the allegations. In La Valle, there was evidence the plaintiff's mother had brought up the conflict with the offending student in a meeting with the principal and her son's teachers. The principal testified he spoke to the offending student about the conflict, but the offending student denied that the principal had spoken to him. So the school's motion for summary judgment was denied in that case. In Emmanuel B., there was no basis for finding that any greater level of supervision than that which was provided would have prevented a sudden and spontaneous altercation between the two students. Schools are not insurers of safety and cannot be expected to continuously supervise and control all movements and activities of students. In matter of Regan, the court allowed the filing of a late notice of claim because the school was deemed to have knowledge of the essential facts of the claim within 1 month of the expiration of the 90-day filing period. In matter of Turlington, the application to file a late notice was denied. The plaintiff student was allegedly attacked by a student who was the subject of an order of protection requiring that student to stay away from the school. Although it was demonstrated the school had notice of the order of protection, it was not shown the school had timely knowledge of the underlying facts of the claim itself. In Lennon, over a strong dissent, the school's motion for summary judgment was denied. The offending student, Ryan, ran toward an exit door while on a school field trip and collided with two other students. The dissent argued finding that negligent supervision was not the proximate cause of injury was against the weight of the evidence. In Guerriero, the last case in the non-recreational student-on-student assault subcategory, the school's motion for summary judgment was denied because the motion papers did not demonstrate that the student's act of violence was spontaneous and unforeseeable, that the student had no time to, that the teacher had no time to intervene, or that the student voluntarily engaged in the fight. The Guerriero decision includes a comprehensive explanation of nearly all the issues that may arise in a negligent supervision case involving a student-on-student assault and should be the starting point for research in this area. The next subcategory that we looked at was student-on-student assault during school recreational activities. In DeMisa, the student plaintiff alleged she was intentionally pushed to the ground by another student during a kickball game. The student sued the school, but also sued the student who allegedly pushed her under a battery theory. Only the denial of summary judgment on the battery cause of action was appealed. In DeMisa, where it was alleged the plaintiff student was intentionally knocked to the ground, the court noted that the assumption of the risk doctrine does not cover risks resulting from either reckless or intentional conduct. In Duffy, the court found the school did not relinquish custody of the student plaintiff merely because classes had ended. The junior varsity football coach had the responsibility to supervise the players after school prior to football practice. In Duffy, where the student plaintiff was injured after being deliberately catapulted into the air using a blocking sled, the court found that the assumption of risk doctrine did not apply to what was characterized as horseplay. The court explained that the doctrine of primary assumption of risk facilitates the free and vigorous participation in athletic activities by placing the risk of participation on the participants themselves rather than the sponsor. The doctrine encourages sponsorship, which leads to more opportunities to participate in sports or other recreational activities. The use of the blocking sled to catapult each other into the air is not the sort of socially valuable, voluntary activity that the doctrine seeks to encourage. The school defendants did not demonstrate the commonly appreciated risks, which are inherent in football, included the risk of injury after being catapulted through the air by a blocking sled. In Perez, the student plaintiff was struck by a ball kicked by another student during recess. In finding the school's summary judgment motion should have been granted, the court explained that schools are not insurers of safety because they cannot be expected to continuously supervise and control all movements and activities of students. Therefore, students cannot be held liable for every thoughtless or careless act by which one pupil may injure another. In Thomas, the student plaintiff was playing basketball in gym class when another student grabbed his left arm from behind and threw or dragged him to the ground as he tried to shoot. The student plaintiff sued the New York City Department of Education, alleging negligent supervision. The court noted that New York City itself is not a proper party to a suit alleging negligence on the part of the Department of Education. And it dismissed the part of the action that was directed at the city. In Thomas, where it was alleged the offending student grabbed the plaintiff's student's arm and dragged him to the ground during a gym class basketball game, the appellate division held that the incident was spontaneous and happened so fast no amount of supervision could have prevented it. The court also found that the prior conduct of the offending student did not put the Department of Education on notice. Therefore, supervision could not have been the proximate cause of plaintiff student's injuries. In Scavelli, the court noted that the compulsory nature of gym class precluded the assumption of risk defense. In Osmanzai, the court explained that summer day camps owe a duty to supervise the campers and will be held liable for foreseeable injuries proximately caused by the absence of adequate supervision. In Osmanzai, the 7-year-old participant in a summer day camp was injured after being pushed during a game of tag. There was evidence the supervision was lax. However, the denial of the Department of Education's motion for summary judgment may have reflected deficiencies in its motion papers as much as strength of the plaintiff's case. The next subcategory that we looked at is the liability of schools for student assaults on employees of the school. In Guerrieri, where a school bus driver alleged an assault by a student, the court explained that a municipality's liability for negligently exercising a governmental function depends on whether there is a special relationship between the municipality and the plaintiff. A school district owes a special duty to its students to supervise them and prevent injuries, but no special duty is owed by the school district to its employees. In Broomer, where a teacher alleged an assault by a student, the court explained the three ways a special relationship can be created. One, when the school district violates a statutory duty enacted for the benefit of a particular class of persons. Two, when the school district voluntarily assumes a duty that generates justifiable reliance by the person who benefits from the duty. Or three, when the school district assumes positive direction and control in the face of a known, blatant, and dangerous safety violation. No special relationship was demonstrated by the teacher in the Broomer case. The next subcategory was a student who was assaulted by an unknown assailant on school grounds. In this case, the initial notice of claim alleged plaintiff, a special needs student who was to be accompanied at all times by an aide, was raped by a white man in the locker room. The plaintiff sought to amend her notice of claim to allege she was raped by an African-American man under the bleachers on the athletic field. The court, over a dissent, allowed the amendment because the theory that the plaintiff was not provided with the level of supervision required of the school was not changed by the amendment. The next subcategory was students assaulted shortly after leaving school grounds. In Diaz, the plaintiff alleged he was stabbed and beaten by 6 gang members after he left the school grounds, about 10 feet from the sawhorse barricades which marked the school's property line. Plaintiff had left the school grounds with hundreds of other students. In Diaz, the school was not liable. The fact that the plaintiff was not in the school's custody or under its control or authority at the time of the assault was one factor in the court's analysis. Lack of foreseeability was another factor. In Diaz, the court noted that the school did not release the plaintiff into a foreseeably hazardous situation that the school had a hand in creating, a circumstance which apparently would trigger liability. In Hernandez, the student plaintiff and her father were assaulted by other students 30 to 100 feet from the entrance of the school. Once the plaintiff left the school grounds, she was no longer in the physical custody or under the control of the school. Therefore, the school's duty to protect the plaintiff had ceased. As the court explained it, a school's duty is coextensive with and concomitant with its physical custody and control over a child. When that custody ceases, because the child has passed out of the orbit of its authority in such a way that the parent is perfectly free to reassume control over the child's protection, the school's custodial duty also ceases. The last subcategory that we looked at was college liability for students injured by other students. Colleges generally have no duty to protect students from the dangerous conduct of other students. In Pasquaretto, the plaintiff was injured pledging for a fraternity and sued the college, alleging negligent supervision of the fraternity's activities. The Pasquaretto court explained that a duty to supervise may be imposed upon a college only where it has encouraged its students to participate in an activity and taken affirmative steps to supervise and control the activity. The plaintiff did not sufficiently allege that the university defendant's involvement in the fraternity's initiation process was of a degree that gave rise to a duty. With respect to the pattern jury instructions, the discussion of the liability of schools based upon inadequate supervision begins on page 664 in volume 1B. That's, again, the third edition, 2017 version. The fourth and final code is pineapple. Again, the fourth and final code word for the CLE is pineapple. The materials for this course were put together in late 2017. So the cases that are referenced in the course only go up to September of 2017. It took some time for the CLE to approve this course, and it also took several months to create this website as a platform for the CLE. That's the reason for the September 2017 cutoff. However, you can easily call up all the decision summaries that are on this this website, New York Appellate Digest, that have been put up since September 2017, so you can catch up. As recently as last week, if anything came out last week. I suggest the following search. You can use the search panel that's on the right side of the page, and in the top line where it says all categories, just click on that and a drop-down menu shows up. You could click on negligence and then choose a start date from the third line down, make it October 1st, 2017, and then type in quotation marks, third party assault, again in quotation marks, third party assault in the search by keywords line, and then click on search. And most of the third party assault summaries should come up, and you can browse through them to see if there's anything that relates to what you're researching. I would just like to point out one case which explains something that I didn't understand before. It's Santaiti, I believe, S-A-N-T-A-I-T-I, versus town of Ramapo, or Ramapo, R-A-M-A-P-O, 162 A.D. 3rd, 921. That's 162 A.D. 3rd, 921. Second Department, June 20th, 2018. And the Second Department, in a very comprehensive and informative analysis, held that the plaintiff had stated a negligence cause of action against the town for the shooting death of plaintiff's decedent, whose name was Nigro, N-I-G-R-O. The town police had responded to Nigro's residence, where she told the police her live-in companion, whose name was Grosbeck, had assaulted her. She also told the police Grosbeck, who was a former New Jersey police officer, had an unlicensed handgun. The police didn't arrest Grosbeck, but they took possession of the handgun. Later, the police returned the handgun to Grosbeck, who subsequently shot and killed Nigro with the gun. The second department found that the complaint adequately alleged a special relationship between Nigro and the town, and further found that the town did not demonstrate the doctrine of governmental immunity applied as a matter of law. So on the issue of a special relationship, the court wrote, construing the complaint liberally and according the plaintiff the benefit of every possible favorable inference, it was sufficient to allege the existence of a special relationship between the town and Nigro. The complaint adequately alleged direct contact between the agents of the town and Nigro, and that the town police department undertook, through promises or actions, an affirmative duty on behalf of Nigro to safeguard Grosbeck's handgun. In addition, the complaint adequately alleged circumstances indicating that the town, through its agents, knew that the return of the handgun to Grosbeck could lead to harm. The town's evidentiary submissions failed to utterly refute these factual allegations as a matter of law, so the complaint was deemed to state a cause of action against the town. The second department then went on to explain the relationship between a plaintiff's negligence suit against the town and the doctrine of governmental immunity. The court explained, the issue of whether a defendant is entitled to governmental immunity is distinct from the issue of whether a special duty exists in a particular case. The doctrine of governmental immunity refers to an affirmative defense on which a defendant bears the burden of proof. The common law doctrine of governmental immunity shields public entities from liability for discretionary actions taken during the performance of governmental functions. In other words, even if a plaintiff establishes all elements of a negligence claim, a state or municipal defendant engaging in a governmental function can avoid liability if it timely raises the defense and proves that the alleged negligent act or omission involve the exercise of discretionary authority. So the point I wanted to make here is that it's not necessary for a plaintiff to make out a prima facie case to negate the possibility that governmental immunity applies. It's an affirmative defense that must be raised by the municipality, but a plaintiff can make out a prima facie case without addressing it. So this concludes this 3.5-hour course entitled Liability and Negligence for an Assault by a Third Party.